This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, we hear about a hijacking in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There was no rebel with a gun, just a refugee woman with a baby.
Anna refused to move. She wanted us to take her home, but she didn't know where home was. She knew towns, but no addresses. She knew names, but they were now the names of ghosts.
Plus, caring for orphans in Afghanistan. The pay is so low. One teacher lives in a cave. And songs of peace from young Somalis. Their band is called Waya Husub. Their music changes lives.
Since the day I was born, I have lived through war. I didn't know the difference between right and wrong, but when I heard Waya Husub, I realized my generation is singing while I am carrying a gun. That is when I stopped.
All that's ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The war in Afghanistan has left many children orphans. Some of them lost their parents when tens of thousands of Hazara people were murdered by the Taliban in the late 1990s. Now, the children are taken care of by a handful of dedicated workers who are themselves living on the edge. Reporter Will Everett brings us this story from Bamyan in central Afghanistan.
A group of children dashes out of a mud brick orphanage to welcome a rare visitor. Their round faces and distinctly Asian eyes reveal their Hazara roots. For most of the 220 kids who live here, this is the only place they've ever called home. Each of them lost family members to Taliban violence in recent years. Since then, their fate has been left to the 10 staff members at this orphanage just outside the city of Bamyan, who do the best they can with the limited resources they have.
The government is supposed to send us a check every quarter for orphanage expenses, but sometimes the check doesn't come.
That's Mohammed Akhlil, the orphanage headmaster.
I have to call Kabul every week and send letters so we can keep the doors open and the orphanage running.
Akhlil, like most of the children and staff here, is Hazara. He says his colleagues in Pashtun orphanages get their checks on time. The Pashtun are the dominant ethnic group in Afghanistan. Akhlil wonders if his checks are delayed because of old prejudices against Hazaras.
I think they do this because we are Hazaras and practice the Shia faith. I can't prove it, but it's a feeling I have.
As headmaster, Akhlil makes only $75 a month. The teachers at this orphanage make even less. Mohammed Amir has been teaching geometry and Pashto here for 5 years. Like most of the teachers here, he has a secondary source of income.
Look at my hands. I'm a farmer. I can't make ends meet as a teacher. When I'm through talking to you, I'm going off to work at my farm.
His family lives in a village outside of Bamyan, but during the week, Amir lives in a mountain cave near his cornfield. Most of his money goes to support his family of eight, so the cave is the only roof he can afford to keep over his head. He furnishes it with nothing more than an old carpet, a water basin, and a grill for cooking. He has to rise before dawn to work the field, then go back to work when he's finished at the orphanage. It's an exhausting way of life. But teaching alone won't pay the bills.
My salary is around $50. That's nothing. A bag of rice costs $10. A can of cooking oil is $14. We have big families of 8 or 10 people, and this won't feed us.
So why does he stay? He struggles to find an answer, then throws his hands in the air in a helpless gesture, as if to say, how could he turn his back on these kids?
There are kids on the streets, 5 and 6 years old, working to feed their families. Kids need a place like this, a place where they can learn in safety. No one else is going to take care of them.
It's a holiday today, so there are no classes. The younger kids play in the dusty orphanage courtyard while the older ones go out to forage for wood. The headmaster, Mohammed Akhlil, draws up the sleeves of his shalwar kameez, the traditional Afghan outfit, and begins chopping wood. Winter is some time away, but it's an enemy always in the back of Akhlil's mind. There's a lot of work to be done here before winter sets in. Some of the doorways have no doors, and many of the windows have no glass. After lunch, the kids jostle with each other to have their pictures taken. Mohammed Amir looks on in the background. If the government doesn't increase his salary, he says he'll have to look for another job. These kids are the reason he's stayed as long as he has. But he knows he can't work two jobs forever. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Bamyan, Afghanistan.
The violence in Afghanistan is getting worse. Places once considered safe are now no-go areas, even for aid organizations. Just a few weeks ago, three women who worked for the International Rescue Committee were killed on their way to Kabul. The aid organization responded by pulling out of the country. Rumors are the Taliban is close to the capital once again. Journalist Will Everett recently returned to the U.S. from a reporting trip to Afghanistan, and he joins me now. Will, we're all hearing that the violence in Afghanistan is actually escalating, and I know it took about a whole day for you to get from Kabul to Bamiyan. I'm wondering what that trip was like.
Well, that's the problem with reporting in Afghanistan, is getting from one place to another, because obviously the problem is the Taliban. And I had a friend who said, well, let's put you on a bus the other way, and it made a long circuitous route through the mountains and back down into Bamiyan so that I would avoid some of the Taliban areas.
What was that like?
Well, it was a 12-hour journey through roads that were like dry creek beds. And it was a little scary because you never know when the Taliban might come along and throw up a roadblock. And what was interesting for me was that on this little bus with about 12 people or so, there was this awareness of my vulnerability. I didn't speak their language. I was all alone, traveling in native garb. And the people on that bus sort of embraced my problem.
Were you the only American on the bus?
Oh, yeah. I was traveling alone. I didn't have my translator. But the foreigners don't travel this way. They travel in armed convoys. There are a lot of situations where I was just completely ignorant of the culture and needed somebody to reach out. You know, we stopped, we bathed. It's a very dusty, dirty journey, and all men on the bus. Women don't travel with men. And there were a few checkpoints where people stopped, looked in the bus, they saw me, and everything changed. They wanted to see papers. They started calling on their radios and stuff. And the people on the bus said, no, he's got his papers. We're moving on. And it was that, it was the force of attitude, I think, more than anything else that got us through that.
Well, it must have been very reassuring.
Yeah, it is. But you know, what's reassuring is that wherever I go in Muslim countries, that same hospitality reaches out to me. And it's always by the common people.
All right, Will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In India, kids of poor construction workers are often left to fend for themselves while their parents are at work. It doesn't sound that unusual, except these families actually live on the construction site, a dangerous place to leave a child unattended. But a few lucky children and their parents now have another option. Peter Aronson reports from Mumbai.
A group of toddlers sit in a circle on a concrete floor as a teacher gently applies baby powder and helps dress them one by one. This daycare center is a tin shack in the middle of a muddy construction site. It's part of a program called Mumbai Mobile Creches. Creche is a British word for nursery. It provides much-needed childcare for the construction workers who live in shacks right next to this one.
Some of the kids who come here haven't had a bath or haven't been cleaned well by their mothers, so it's essential to ensure that they're properly cleaned. Their parents go to work, and they don't have enough time to take care of all their children.
That's Vaishali Chandrakant Apras, the director of this daycare. Usually both parents work, leaving no one to care for the kids. These migrant families are amongst the poorest of India's poor, so they have few options, says Apras.
If there were no mobile creche, these children would be wandering around aimlessly. They would be playing in the dirt.
Instead, they spend their days drawing, painting, singing, and if they're old enough, learning to read and write. The center measures only about 650 square feet, and yet it's neatly divided. There's a preschool area where cloths suspended hammock-style serve as cribs, and there's a play area with chalkboards and a little classroom with red, yellow, green, and blue desks. The walls are plastered with students' drawings, the Hindi alphabet, and paper chains. At breakfast time, Vaishali ladles warm milk and a protein porridge called ragi into the kids' metal cups. She chants a little song which they repeat. It's a daily ritual. children who finish their milk and ragi will become strong and healthy and will look good, the song goes. Devika Mahadevan is the chief executive of Mumbai Mobile Creches. She says the group was founded in 1969 by a well-off housewife in Delhi who was walking past a construction site one day.
And she came across this baby that was just lying in the middle of the dust and in the harsh heat and just crying. And its mother was away working on the site. And I think that touched her so much, she realized that this child is all alone, is completely vulnerable. So right then and there, she started the first mobile creches center, but the aim was just to protect and take care of these very young children.
There are now 60 centers in the cities of Delhi, Mumbai, and Pune. They take children up to age 12. The youngest child ever left in their care was only 3 days old. The group gets its money from the government, private donations, and the construction companies themselves. The builders also have to provide a place to house the center. It's not all that costly, but
there are many sites where children are constantly having accidents and dying, and they still don't have a center.
Without this free daycare, 4- and 5-year-olds often end up looking after their younger siblings.
By providing a mobile crash center, you actually take away the burden of childcare from the young child, and you support the parents.
Parents like Sarasvati and her husband Karyappa, they came to work on this construction site from a poor village in South India. While she carries trays of bricks and gravel on her head, her 3 kids spend their days at the center. The couple says they're grateful for the program.
I come to check on my kids around 4 at the creche. I see whether they're studying, playing, crying. I just check on them and then I leave.
Education is beneficial because they can at least learn the basics, how to recognize or read a bus number, how to read signs, and this matters a lot.
The center also gives the children confidence to try new things. 12-year-old Naresh has shown a talent for art.
I used to see other kids drawing, and I used to wonder, why can't I draw as well as them? And so one day I just picked up the little chalkboard, and I put my hand to the board, and I just started to try drawing.
Thanks to private donations, he took some art classes. But Naresh also takes home more basic knowledge.
Especially about cleanliness, about how to keep my house clean, about how to wash my hands, that I shouldn't allow flies to sit on my food, because goodness knows what will happen.
Unfortunately, when the construction work here is done, most of these children will end up on sites with no mobile creche. But the organization has been training a group of 10 women, all wives of construction workers, as daycare providers. The hope is that these women will one day be able to run their own low-cost programs that can move from site to site with their families, making them truly mobile creches. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Mumbai, India.
Coming up, we meet a woman who grew up in poverty and then turned her story into a best-selling memoir. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. If you've traveled to developing countries, you know that it can be tricky to figure out when or if to give money to people begging on the streets. It's especially difficult to refuse when the person asking is a child. But giving money might not always be helpful in the long run. Our Mexico correspondent, Conrad Fox, brings us this report.
At a busy intersection, the light turns red. That's the moment 7-year-old Carla Chontal steps out into the road, carrying a handful of homemade lollipops. The curly-haired girl walks down the line of cars, hawking the treats and grinning broadly. Most drivers seem to stare through her, but occasionally she makes a sale. She scurries with the money to her mother, who waits on the traffic island in a wheelchair. Her mother, Elvira, has a deformed leg, so it's much easier for her daughter to get to the customers. But that's not the only reason Carla is the one who's making the sales today.
She sells more than I do. She's so tiny and dark-skinned and smiley. People love that. She sells the candy like hotcakes.
Carla works on this street most afternoons and evenings, earning about $10 a day. It's her family's only steady source of income. It's common here to see children washing car windows, shining shoes, or selling food or trinkets at intersections and in parks. Often, they're accompanied by an adult who pockets the money.
It's more likely that when people see a kid, they give money and feel like they've cleared their conscience. But that's the worst thing they can do.
Mally Flores is the head of the city's family welfare department. For more than 2 years now, she's been trying a novel technique to curb the number of children working the streets. A publicity campaign called Helping Hurts Them. The message? Don't give money to kids on the street. It may sound mean-spirited, but she says the aim is far from it.
It's not cruelty. Children have no obligation to support their parents, and giving money just encourages this kind of thing. As soon as they cease to be a business, they can start enjoying their rights as children.
Flores' campaign uses billboards and TV ads to warn the public that giving money to children encourages parents to put their kids to work on the streets. She has little sympathy for the argument that the money these children make may be the family's only source of income.
The parents have to get off their duffs. They've got to say, okay, I've got kids, and it's my obligation to maintain them. Here at the Family Welfare Department, we offer lots of free training courses in dressmaking, hairdressing, computers, electronics. We've got a job board. It's the obligation of the parents to say, I can't let my child support me. What can I do?
Despite the campaign, many Boca del Rio residents admit, grudgingly, they do give money to kids on the street. Like this man, who says he gives money if the kid looks really poor. And this one, who says, yeah, I give money if the kid washes my windows. As part of the Helping Hurts Them program, the Family Welfare Department offers $50 a month to families whose children are working on the street. The catch? They have to send their kids to school instead. The department even offers to look after preschoolers free of charge at city daycares. But Department Director Mally Flores admits, so far, they've had no takers. Elvira Chontal sees nothing wrong with having her daughter work.
Almost every day the department comes by wanting to take my kids, but I don't let them. Is it so bad to teach them to sell? What do people want, that I teach them to rob?
Then her daughter Carla hops off the curb, hands a lollipop to a driver, takes 10 pesos, about a dollar, and hurries back to her mom with the money. Her mom kisses the coin before pocketing it. It looks like she won't be giving up her daughter's assistance anytime soon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Boca del Rio, Mexico.
Jeanette Walls could have used a few extra pennies as a child. She grew up extremely poor in rural America. But years later, Walls built a life for herself as a journalist in New York City. Jeanette Walls' unusual childhood remained a secret from almost everyone who knew her professionally. That was until she wrote a story about her childhood. The book is called The Glass Castle. It became a bestseller, and Walls' secret was out. We invited Jeanette Walls onto the show to tell us her story. Here she is, reading from the first pages of her book.
I was sitting in a taxi, wondering if I had overdressed for the evening, when I looked out a window and saw Mom rooting through a dumpster. It was just after dark. A blustery March wind whipped the steam coming out of the manholes, and people hurried along the sidewalks with their collars turned up. I was stuck in traffic 2 blocks from the party where I was heading. It had been months since I laid eyes on Mom, and when she looked up, I was overcome with panic that she'd see me and call out my name, and that someone on the way to the same party would spot us, and Mom would introduce herself, and my secret would be out.
You talk about being on your way to a party, Jeanette, when you see your mom. What would someone at that party be shocked to know about your family, your childhood?
Basically everything. I was beyond impoverished. I mean, some of the details of my childhood, I don't think I'd even really thought about that much, that I'd eaten food out of garbage cans, that I'd slept in a cardboard box. We were always running from, Dad said it was the CIA and the mafia. Mom said it was just bill collectors. But we were always running from some small town to some small town, staying in hotels or sleeping in cars or just ending up wherever we ended up. You know, the past is a funny way of catching up with you. I thought I'd escaped it, but we had no money, and I basically came to New York, and I tried to make a new life for myself, and then my parents followed.
Now, Jeanette, at one point when you were a little girl, your family moved to West Virginia, in the Appalachian Mountains. And you write about the house that you and your brother and sisters lived in. Can you just describe that little house on the end of that road?
It had no indoor plumbing. It was wired for electricity, but the electricity was usually turned off because we didn't pay the bills. There were three rooms, if you count the kitchen, which nobody would go into. There was no bathroom. And my mother and father slept in the living room, and us four kids slept in the bedroom. It leaked so badly that my brother had to put a tarp over himself so that the water wouldn't get on him in the night whenever there was a rainstorm. It literally was falling apart.
Did you think of yourself as poor?
Yeah, I suppose we did. But at the same time, even when somebody talks about me today and say, well, you were poor back then. I mean, we were beneath poor. You know, we were poor. We couldn't afford the last OR poor. I mean, I really do remember looking at other kids that were considered poor white trash. And I wanted to put tires in front of our house and paint them white because at least we'd fit in a little bit more. But at the same time, I did sort of buy into my parents' dreams and their hopes and aspirations. And I honestly think that that's in some ways what set us apart from the other kids. I remember one time I stopped by one of my brother's friend's places, and I remember looking around. The mother was making breakfast. They had coal and they had food, and I was thinking, gosh, this would be nice. I'm not asking for a lot, but this would be enough. And then right then the father came downstairs and looked at what my brother's friend was doing. He was drawing a picture, and the father smacked him upside the head for putting on airs and thinking he was an artist. And I remember thinking, God, I'm the lucky one here. Because despite whatever we didn't have, my parents did believe in education, and I believe they gave us a sense of self-esteem.
Did you actually go to school hungry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, all the time. I mean, we were hungry. There was no food in the house. But it's funny, hunger, you know, if you've been hungry for a couple of days, the feeling of hunger changes. It actually becomes a little bit less and becomes more like an ache. I remember one time when I was in the girls' room at school and seeing somebody throwing away a lunch. And I looked at it and thought, you know, I'm really hungry. And I just reached down and got it and went into one of the stalls and ate it. And after that, that became the place that I would go for lunch. And I never told anybody until the book came out. And this was something that was just, it was such a source of shame for me. And a television show did a little segment on it. We went back to Welch High School and they asked me, they said, well, where's the garbage can where you dug out the food? My brother had gone on the shoot with us. And he said, do you want to see the garbage can where I dug out the food? And I felt like somebody said, just kick me in the stomach. I had no idea that he was doing the same thing, but of course he was. I mean, where else would he be getting the food? We never discussed it. You do what you got to do to get through.
Did any of your teachers or other adults notice you were in trouble, that you were hungry, that you weren't dressed appropriately, or did you hide it pretty well?
I went to great lengths to hide how poor we were. You know, we didn't have running water, so we would catch rainwater. But when it was snowing or freezing, we couldn't get the rainwater. And I would literally go out and get handfuls of snow and rub it on my face trying to clean myself up. And since the publication of the book, my ninth grade English teacher, I've reestablished contact with her. And she was being interviewed by somebody. And she told me something that really stuck with me. She said she remembers working with me on a paper one time. She was a lovely woman. And seeing that my hands were dirty above my wrist, my arms were dirty. And she said that the realization flashed through her mind, oh, my God, Jeanette's family doesn't have indoor plumbing. And she said, the next thought was, if she's made it this far, she's going to be okay. So she purposefully pushed the thought out of her mind. And I personally think that that shows astonishing sensitivity. Because if the look in Mrs. Owen's eyes, the look of admiration and respect for me had been replaced with one of pity, I think it would have just broken my heart. And I'm not saying that that's the case for everybody. I mean, certainly some kids should be taken away from parents. Some kids need intervention and need to get some food in that house. But for me, I just wanted the same opportunities as the other kids.
So the obvious question is, how in the world did you make it out of this crazy life you lived to become a very successful New York professional?
I was still in high school. I came up to New York and I finished. There's a wonderful program in New York City where you have internships in lieu of classes. And I got an internship at a paper in Brooklyn. And they hired me as soon as I graduated. And I thought I had it made. I was making $125 a week and I was a reporter and it's really great. And then one day the editor sent me down and he said, you really should go to college. And I was a little hurt because I thought he was trying to fire me. And I said, you know, I've got a great job. You know, I have made it. And he said, no, there are better jobs out there, but you've got to get a college education. So I went to Barnard and I got grants, loans, and scholarships to pay for most of it. I lived with a woman and I took care of her kids in exchange for a room. And I held down two jobs while I was going to college and taking care of the kids. And in retrospect, that was a lot of work. That was quite a load. But compared to my childhood, it was a piece of cake. It just, everything seemed so easy by comparison to what I'd been through.
And books really saved your life pretty much, didn't they? Would you say it's all the
Absolutely.
Reading of books you did?
Yes. Yes. My mother was just very adamant about, we would go to the library all the time, and she should take a pillowcase and fill it up and sling it over her shoulder like Santa Claus and come home with just dozens and dozens of books, and we read constantly.
Was that a great escape for you?
You know, it's funny. My older sister liked escapist literature, but it wasn't escape for me. I liked books about people who had tough lives, and I didn't see that as much as escape. I saw it more as a manual for how to change things. I remember I loved Grapes of Wrath. You know, it's like, this is a family sort of like ours. There was a teacher who told me that she has a student in northern Alabama who really doesn't like to read. And this is the first book he read cover to cover, which I hope it doesn't sound like I'm bragging, but I love that. And she asked him, she said, you know, what is it you like about that book? And he said, this here is a fine white trash story. And she added very quickly, he meant that as a compliment. But I took it as a compliment, because if some kid who sees himself as trash can identify with my story, then that makes me happier than I can possibly say. And it's been so ironic for me that since the publication of my book, the number of people who've come up to me and said, you know, the details of our lives are very different, but we have so much in common. And then they'll start telling me things about themselves. And it makes me realize my story is not unique, and that there are so many people like me out there. And the great gift that readers have given me back in exchange for coming clean about my story is that they've taken me out of my sort of self-imposed isolation, thinking that I was weird and I was a freak and that if everybody knew the truth about me, they'd hate me. And instead, they've sort of said, we're a lot alike. And it's changed the world for me from a place filled with potential enemies to one filled with potential friends.
All right, Jeanette Walls, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was journalist Jeanette Walls speaking to us from New York. AIDS activists in Indonesia are struggling to stop the spread of HIV in their country, but a lack of money and will is working against them. From Java, Trish Anderton has our story. Just one word of caution, this story contains sexual content that might be inappropriate for children.
It's Saturday night in Surabaya, the capital of Indonesia's sex industry. In the red light district of Bangunsari, music booms from bars and brothels while women sit on chairs by the road looking for customers. Prostitution is illegal in Indonesia, but is tacitly accepted in red light districts like these. Some of Indonesia's estimated 230,000 sex workers are lured into the business by the promise of big money, while others are tricked or trapped into it. Many start young. For a 16-year-old we'll call Anna, it all began when she ran away from home after a bad end to a bad relationship. She tried to find work as a housemaid, but failed.
I was offered a job at a discotheque instead, so I accepted the job because what the heck, I had been betrayed.
Anna has been a sex worker for more than a year now. She says she tried to get out of the industry, but her employer beat her. Anna doesn't have much power over her life or her body. Today she's exercising one of the few choices she does have. She's getting tested to find out whether she has HIV. A counselor at a women's health clinic speaks with Anna about how HIV is spread and how it can be prevented. Anna already knows about condoms, but knowledge isn't necessarily protection. Esti Susanti Hudiono is the founder and head of Hotline Surabaya, the organization that runs this clinic.
From the sex worker's perspective, condoms do not solve anything. The sex workers know that it is almost impossible to ask their customers to use condoms.
Esti says when she first started doing anti-HIV work more than a decade ago, she expected to make quick progress.
I thought this would be an easy job, just promote condoms face-to-face. Easy, because people will be told about the risks of sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, and the others. It turns out we still haven't succeeded.
Esti worked to pass a local law in 2004 requiring sex workers' customers to use condoms. This so-called 100% use approach has worked in Thailand, where the Thai government says it led to an astounding 80% drop in new HIV infections. But it's had little impact in Surabaya. The law here isn't being enforced because of bureaucracy and insufficient funding. Hotline Surabaya is focusing on more than HIV prevention through condom use. It also tries to keep young women from becoming prostitutes in the first place. It runs an anti-trafficking program in a village that supplies many prostitutes to Surabaya. That effort includes education and job training, as well as a theater program to help teenagers learn to speak up for their rights. And here in the city, it's reaching out to the children of sex workers. In a small room in Bangunsari, teachers sing, read, and write with kids from the neighborhood. Joris Lato runs the program.
We've seen that houses here are one room for the whole family, with a mother and father and kids and kitchen and TV, so there's no room to study.
Joris says many children of prostitutes can't go to school because they don't have birth certificates. That's because a marriage certificate is often required first, and sex workers rarely have one. Those who do go to school often face ostracism by students and even teachers because their mothers are sex workers. Teachers with Hotline Surabaya fill in the children's educational gaps and try to keep them off the streets.
We see teenagers trafficked by their own parents. At first, they're taught to sing in the street for money. Then, when they're older, the girls are offered for sale to men.
As for Anna, the girl at the beginning of this story, she turned out to be HIV negative, but she's still living on the edge. Hotline Surabaya sometimes offers job training programs to help prostitutes find other work, but it doesn't have one now. In a country where half the workforce is unemployed or underemployed, Anna doesn't have much hope of getting a good job. And until condom use becomes more widespread, she's still at high risk for HIV. For the World Vision Report, I'm Trish Anderton in Surabaya, Indonesia.
Music with a Mission, coming up on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and this is Wayahusub. They're a group of Somali refugees who use their music to break down age-old barriers. We'll hear more from them in a bit. But first, here's a famous protest song. It's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance.
And it's hard, it's hard. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall is the name of the Bob Dylan protest song that defined the 60s. It's now the title of an outdoor exhibit that's touring the world. The song was a response to the threat of nuclear war. The exhibition is a response to the problems facing the world in the 21st century. Dramatic photographs and writings that address poverty, climate change, and human rights are displayed on a 100-foot-long banner. Each photograph illustrates an image from Dylan's famous song. So visitors to the exhibit hear the song and see the image at the same time. A forest in Haiti without any trees because the wood was needed for cooking fuel. Land that once provided food for the local community cracking under the weight of drought. The banners are displayed in botanical gardens all around the world, from Sweden to Sydney, London to Madrid. The exhibit shows the deep connection between people and the environment in which they live. The creator, Mark Edwards, was inspired by something John F. Kennedy said, "Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man." And that's our Globe at a Glance.
It's hard, it's hard, and it's hard, it's hard rain, they're gonna fall.
Kenya is home to thousands of Somali refugees who fled the 17-year civil war there. A group of refugee teenagers have done what kids all over the world do. They've formed a band.
The members of Waya Husub want their music to break down barriers and bring peace to their homeland. As Richard Locke reports, they've started to do just that. But their success has come at a price.
That's the sound of Waya Husub, a hip-hop group from Little Mogadishu, a brash, chaotic suburb of Nairobi. The band's name means New Era. Most of its members are Somali teenagers who fled their country over the course of its 16-year civil war. They're among the 150,000 Somalis living in Little Mogadishu, giving the place its name. Shine Abdullahi founded the band 4 years ago. Standing on a rooftop in his neighborhood, the 20-year-old says he wanted to reach out to young Somalis still caught up in the fighting.
I felt bad when I saw people my age and younger generations carrying guns and taking drugs, making a big mess. I want to try and bring change to the country and the people.
Down below, in a cramped, poorly soundproofed recording studio, the group rehearses a track called Problems in Our Country. The lyrics rebuke Somali warlords for tearing their country apart. Mohamed Abdi Jamal is a singer with the band, but just weeks ago, he was in Somalia, brandishing an automatic rifle and extorting money at roadblocks. He says if people didn't pay up fast, he did, as he puts it, whatever was necessary. But then the 18-year-old heard Waya Husub on a local radio station. He says he was moved by the group's message of reconciliation and realized how senseless the killing was. So moved, he put down his gun and crossed the Kenyan border to join the band.
Since the day I was born, I have lived through war. I didn't know the difference between right and wrong, but when I heard Waya Husub, I realized my generation is singing while I am carrying a gun. That is when I stopped.
In this song, Jamal makes a direct appeal to the young militiamen who are still bringing death and misery to their own people. The chorus pleads, "Let's not divide ourselves according to clan. If everyone holds on to a gun, no one will sleep, no one will rest. Leave the people alone." Jamal wants to use his story as an example to others.
I have seen the reality. I have killed. So I ask Somalis, why are you continuing if I myself have stopped?
But this message of reconciliation has earned the band hatred. Band leader Shine Abdullahi says they've received death threats from Somali warlords, who've got a vested interest in keeping the fighting going. And they've also received threats from radical Islamic groups because some of their songs deal with taboo subjects.
We're receiving threats from Ali Jihad, Al-Qaeda, and Somali warlords and leaders of certain clans. They threaten to kill us like they did a young boy distributing our CDs in Mogadishu.
In Nairobi, one female band member now lives in hiding after an attacker slashed her face. Her wrongdoing? She bared her navel in a music video. Now the band's lead female vocalist, 18-year-old Falis Abdi, wears a full veil on the streets of Little Mogadishu, all because of her liberal stance on Somali tradition.
The way they threaten me is when, especially when I'm walking on the streets, I can't walk with my face open so that nobody notices. Otherwise, if I'm just walking like that, they throw stones at me and they say that this is the girl who's spoiling our kids' generation.
In this track called Love, Abdi tells parents to let their daughters choose the man they love. For her, it's a personal story. Her parents chased away the man she once loved because he wasn't from the same clan. Both Abdi and bandleader Abdullahi are adamant they won't be cowed into silence.
I'm not scared of the threats any longer. They continue. Even last week we received a new threat. They're using Somali people to threaten us in Nairobi. So the problem is getting worse, but we won't stop.
The band's a big hit with young people across the region. So much so, the United Nations wanted Waya Husub to play at recent reconciliation talks in Mogadishu. But the band declined, fearing their lives would be at risk. There's a further twist in the band's tale. The group's lead rapper, Q-Rap, comes from Ethiopia, a traditional enemy of Somalia.
They showed me love, though they knew I'm Ethiopian, but
They never treated me like I'm some kind of, from different clan. They were so friendly, so smiling, loved and everything. So, I felt like they're just part of my soul, just like a friend of mine. I could do anything for them, they could do anything for me. They showed me that kind of way, so I had to join the group.
He says many Ethiopians living in Nairobi take a dim view of his relationship with these young Somalis.
Hey, you're selling out your country, But the thing is, I'm glad I'm facing this kind of stuff, because that will make me feel like I'm a soldier with no blood on my hand. And I'm fighting with my words.
Members of Wayahusub say they'll continue singing the message of reconciliation for as long as the fighting continues. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Little Mogadishu, Nairobi, Kenya.
Not long after Richard met Wayahusub, their band leader was shot in the pelvis. After several days in the hospital, he was released. He still doesn't know who was behind the attack. Such violence isn't uncommon in some parts of Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, whole swaths of the country are controlled by dozens of armed groups. For a woman, it's one of the most harrowing places in the world to call home. Michael Cavanaugh saw this firsthand, and he sent us this reporter's notebook from the town of Goma in eastern Congo.
A few weeks ago, my car was taken hostage. It's not uncommon here. Armed men line the region's muddy roads and hijack passing cars for cash and cell phones or to transport their wounded. Only a few weeks before, while traveling with aid workers, my car was chased down by two men with guns and spears. Rebels, who wouldn't let us pass until I convinced them we had permission to be there by showing photos of their commander on my digital camera. A week later, the same group of aid workers had their car shot at and everything stolen. But this time, when my car was taken, I wasn't driving through the forest. I wasn't even driving. I was in the parking lot of a hospital run by an organization called Heal Africa. I was about to start a two-day journey deep into the bush with a team of Congolese doctors who were going to perform surgeries on the war's most isolated victims. But on this morning, a young woman with a four-month-old baby on her back climbed into my car and refused to get out. I'll call her Anna. She was about 23. Anna was Rwandan and had come to Congo as a refugee in 1994 after the Rwandan genocide. The fighting in Congo had pushed her deeper and deeper into the forest. Everyone in her family had been killed. She'd been raped, repeatedly, by armed men from all sides. The baby on her back was the result of her most recent rape, just over a year ago. Anna was epileptic, and her fits often came when she saw fire. And that explains the burns on her arms. She'd fallen into the flames of a kitchen fire. Older scars on her body were from the time a rebel group burned down her house. Now she was in my car. The doctors pleaded with her to get out. Anna refused to move. She wanted us to take her home. But she didn't know where home was. She knew towns, but no addresses. She knew names, but they were now the names of ghosts. Tears poured out her eyes, but her crying seemed emotionless. She stared out at a point in the distance, to some other place and time, perhaps one that still held the possibility of happiness. When she came to the hospital months before, burned and pregnant, several members of the staff offered to adopt her baby. In Congo, babies born of rape are even more stigmatized than rape victims. Anna refused. War had taken everything from her, her home, her country, her family, her youth. The child, wrapped tightly to Anna's back, was the embodiment of her trauma. But it was also her reason to live. Perhaps the only reason. Yet what kind of future is there in war-ravaged Congo for a penniless, epileptic, traumatized rape victim and her three-month-old child? The staff of Heal Africa is saintly, but they can only do so much. After an hour in the car, Anna relented. A nurse led her back into the hospital. Her burns still needed to heal, so maybe in a few months she could leave, although no one could say where she'd go. Our religions tell us stories of the redemptive power of suffering. Our myths talk about rising from the ashes. Our poets point out the flowers that spring from graves. In Anna's story, I struggle to find some sort of redemption.
Michael Cavanaugh's reporting in the DRC was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Eric Herman is the co-founder of the Modiba Music Label. It's a company with a mission. It blends music with a call for social justice. The label's second album features Via Farkatoure from Mali. His father, Ali Farkatoure, was one of Mali's most famous musicians. Eric Herman joins us to talk about Via's debut album, which came about despite his father's objections.
Ali had actually forbade Via, his son, to play music for much of his son's life. His son showed precocious talents in music, but as soon as he started taking those seriously, Ali pulled him aside and discouraged him strongly from entering the music industry as such.
Since he was a musician himself, that's surprising.
Well, he was a musician, but he was never very fond of the trade. He had had some very bad experiences with European producers and such, where his music was exploited and he felt his culture was exploited and he was disrespected and ripped off and that sort of thing. And so he just thought it was a shady, kind of sinister world, and he didn't want his son to enter into it. But Via inherited his father's stubbornness. The fact that his father eventually did give his blessing, and not only that, but to come in and participate on his son's debut album in his dying months, well, he actually had to be carried into the studio. He was so weak with the bone cancer that was eventually going to take his life. It was just such an overwhelmingly emotional day in the studio for everyone.
What was that experience like, watching this father who had once vowed never to let his son play actually participate in putting his first album together while he was dying of cancer? What was that day like?
It was, of course, enormously emotional. I mean, I was filming at the time. Ali, like I said, he was carried into the studio by a few members of his family, and he couldn't even make it into the recording booth. They put him down in the mixing booth and dropped his guitar in his lap. I was filming from inside the recording booth where Via was playing, so the two of them were just barely able to make some eye contact. They just started playing together, and Ali was just almost bleeding through his guitar. You could really feel the strength and the suffering of his character through what he was playing. It's a track called Tabara, which Ali taught to Via.
Is this Ali playing here?
Yeah, it's Ali up front on the electric and Via's on the acoustic.
Now, you started out in your musical career with African music wanting to put the music and a message, a political message of African struggle, together. Does this album also contain some kind of message about Africa's struggle?
Absolutely. This album is the kind of flagship of Modiba and Via Farkatoure's Fight Malaria campaign. And so this was a campaign that we had in mind when we first approached Via. The malaria issue was at the forefront of all of this as we were discussing and negotiating. And their conditions were that we direct the proceeds to Via's hometown of Niafunke, which is a small town in northern Mali, just about 100 kilometers from Timbuktu. And there, malaria is rampant and many children die of the disease, which is easily preventable and curable. We thought it was a really, really important issue to address, and so 10% of the proceeds from this album and from the Via Farkatoure remixed album, which has come out of this, and as well, we have Fight Malaria t-shirts. So all of these are going towards this campaign, and we hope to raise enough money to buy 15,000 insecticide-treated mosquito nets for the children and pregnant mothers of Niafunke.
So, Eric, you're just 24, right?
Yeah.
You're 24, you're already producing albums, and you're able to combine your love for African music with social justice.
Yeah, well, I feel very blessed and fortunate to be where I am at this point, and can only hope that we can see continued success for our projects and for our causes. It's a very daunting challenge that we're up against, especially since Africa gets so little genuine attention over here, and its music even less. But it deserves so much more, and it has so much to teach us and so much beautiful music to share with us that I think I'll be constantly motivated to keep evolving this company and just putting out great music.
Eric Herman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
To learn more about Modiba and the album by Via Farka Touré, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. And that's it for our show today. Remember, you can hear us online or download a podcast of this show and listen to us anytime. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.